I'd like for us to take this session and talk a little bit about the resurrection of Jesus Christ and the importance of that for our faith. When we think about the resurrection of Jesus, start by thinking about, you know, what are some various evidences or reasons you would give for believing in God? We think about God's existence. We think about maybe arguments like cosmological arguments, the existence in the beginning of the universe begs an explanation, or maybe design arguments, design requires a designer, maybe the moral arguments, where does morality come from, and things of that nature. And the thing about those types of arguments, as powerful as they can be, they are pointers to God, but by themselves they don't necessarily prove that Jesus is the Son of God. And so the power of the historical resurrection, I believe, is found in the fact that not only does it point to God himself, but it also points to Jesus as the Son of God. It establishes both the existence of God and that Jesus is the Son of God. Romans chapter 1, verses 3 and 4 talk about Jesus being the Son of David according to the flesh and the Son of God according to the Holy Spirit. The power that is found in the resurrection there to establish the identity of Jesus as divine, as God manifested in the flesh, and as the Son of God, there's a certain power to that. And this is based upon Jesus' own claims. For example, in Matthew chapter 16, after Peter had confessed Jesus to be the Christ, the Son of God, Jesus then tells his disciples, I've got to go to Jerusalem and suffer and be killed and raised again on the third day. That's when Peter said, well, this can't happen to you, Lord. But I want you to notice that Jesus not only predicts his death, but his resurrection as well. The other thing to bear in mind about the importance of the resurrection here is that everything hinges on this. Everything hinges on this because Paul said that is the case in 1 Corinthians 15, which we will spend some time with here momentarily. Paul makes the point that if Jesus were not raised from the dead, then your faith is vain. And our preaching is vain. And those who have died have just perished. And so basically, if there's no resurrection, there is no Christianity. And we might as well pack up and go home if it didn't really happen. And so everything hinges on that. And in 1 Corinthians 15, Paul says in verse 3 there, this is of first importance. Now, when an apostle says, this is the most important thing, we better pay attention to that because it's the most important thing. And so Paul says, this is of first importance to us. The other thing to bear in mind, and if you're in 1 Corinthians 15, take a look at the very end of the chapter. After discussing the various details of the resurrection, that Jesus was raised from the dead, he's the first fruits of those who will be raised from the dead, there will be an end time resurrection in which all of us will be raised, we will be changed, and all of that will happen. And then at the very end, in verse 58, he says, therefore, my beloved brethren, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that your toil, your labor is not in vain in the Lord. That's an important passage for us here. You've got to know that what you do for the Lord is worthwhile. And the way to know that is the resurrection. So I just like to tell people, look, if you get this figured out, other things will fall into place. We all have questions that we want to have answered. And there are things that we're not sure about sometimes. But the reality is, if we can get the resurrection figured out, we can have trust in the one who does know everything. And so then these other things can fall into place after that. This was also the apologetic, the defense of the first century Christians. In the book of Acts, you look at the various sermons, Peter's sermon in Acts 2, Paul's sermon in Acts 13. They're talking about the resurrection. And at the end of chapter 17, when Paul is talking to the people at Athens, what does he say? But that there would be a time when God will judge the world by a man whom he has appointed, and he's furnished proof by raising him from the dead. And it's at that point where some thought, well, you know, we don't want to hear more about this, and others were interested. But the point is that this is what they talked about, and we need to talk about it. We can't just take it for granted that others are going to accept that, but we need to talk about the importance of the resurrection. And the thing to bear in mind is that the basic question is this: was the same person who died seen alive again? We don't have to overcomplicate it. Here, a person died, Jesus Christ died on a cross. Was he seen alive again? And that's what we have to think about. So the power of the resurrection is important as it establishes God's existence. It establishes Jesus as the Son of God. So there are basic considerations that we want to think about here, various ideas to understand as we would develop a case for the resurrection of Jesus. There's a lot of places we could go with this. I'm just going to give some what we would consider to be kind of bare minimum facts to think about. That first of all, Jesus was a real person, real man, who died by crucifixion, and he was buried. And that's attested to by outside sources. There's no real need to have to go into great detail here. Most people accept that. You're going to run into some people occasionally who say, well, I don't think there's evidence that Jesus ever lived. Understand that historians really don't question that. Jesus lived, and they knew that, and he was crucified. And again, that's attested by outside sources. Secondly, his disciples believed that they saw him alive again. Now, this is where it starts getting a little trickier. They did believe it. And again, the reason I word it that way is important because if I were talking to somebody and I said, well, the second point is that disciples saw him alive again, they're going to say, wait a minute, that begs the question. So I start with the basic. They believed it. And that's important because it says something about the nature of their own commitment. They claimed this as firsthand eyewitnesses. And there was a radical transformation that occurred in the lives of the disciples, and it really shows how serious they were. The reason for that is because liars make poor martyrs, as some have argued. And somebody might say, well, now, wait a minute. Don't people die for lies today? Well, yeah, they do. Let me ask you this, though. Do they die knowing it's a lie? Well, are they willing to die for something that they know, absolutely know, is a lie? I'll give them this. If they die for what we believe to be a lie, they're dying for what they think is the truth. Okay, so you give them credit for their commitment to what they believe. But yeah, people die for lies, but what the difference here with the disciples is this. If they didn't really see Jesus, and yet they're claiming to have seen him, they knew they were lying about it. And that's the difference here. Some people die for lies that they don't know is a lie. Jesus died for the truth. The disciples died for believing that they saw him again and standing up for that. Why would they do that if they didn't really believe it? But the fact is, if they were lying about it, they knew they were lying about it. No question about that. And that's an important difference between what the disciples did as claiming to be firsthand witnesses. If I were going to die today for the sake of Christ, I can't do it saying I was an eyewitness, I was there. I would do it based on what I have received down in time, and I believe it is the truth, and I want to be willing to do that. But the first disciples were saying, we were there, we saw. 1 John chapter 1, we saw, we touched, we were there. And they repeated that time and again. They were eyewitnesses. And so if they died for a lie, they knew they were lying about it. So that's one big difference here. The other question about that is, how do you explain the rise of the early church? The early church came into existence on the grounds that Jesus was raised from the dead. They didn't come into existence simply on the grounds that someone died. They came into existence on the grounds that Jesus died and rose again. That's the essence of Peter's sermon in Acts 2. If there's no resurrection, there's no early church. And so that has to be explained based upon the disciples' claims that they saw him alive again. Another factor here is how Paul and James, who are both skeptics, by the way, how they came to believe in Jesus. Now, we're going to come back to Paul momentarily, but I do think it's interesting when you consider someone like James, the Lord's brother, especially. Because, you know, by the time you get into Acts 20, 21, and through there, James has already established himself, back in chapter 15, established himself as a leader in the early church. Now, here's the thing. We read in passages like John 7 that Jesus' own brothers didn't believe. Or in Mark 3, his family thought he had lost his senses. And there's no reason to think James was not among them there. And let me ask you this. I'd like to ask this in person. You know, how many of you have siblings? If you have a brother, for example, what would it take to convince you that your brother was the Son of God? Most of us would really kick back against that kind of a thing if we know our brothers very well. But yet something turned James to Jesus and as a believer. And I believe the answer to that is found in 1 Corinthians 15, when he simply says in verse 7, "Then he appeared to James." So Jesus appeared to James. James was an eyewitness to the resurrected Jesus Christ. We could also talk about the tomb and the various explanations that are given for the empty tomb. That the tomb was empty, obviously, is important from the standpoint that if the body of Jesus were still there, we couldn't be talking about the resurrection. There is a significance to the fact that it was in Jerusalem that this was taking place. Jerusalem was not a friendly place to Christianity initially. Bear in mind that you had a lot of opposition there. And yet all these events are happening right there publicly in a place that was hostile to the first Christians. And yet even the enemies of Jesus acknowledge the body's gone. And I think it's also significant to recognize this. If you read in the gospel accounts, who were the first ones to testify to the raised Jesus? And the answer is women were the first to testify. And that's important in that culture in that time. We don't think about it so much today, but in that day, women typically were not allowed to testify in courts of law. Many would have thought that their testimony was just wild speculation and so forth. And yet the consistent testimony of the Gospels is that women were the first to see it. If you were going to make this up, if you were going to invent this story down the road, maybe late first century, and you want to pass it off as something that people are going to accept and believe, you're not going to put women to be the first ones to testify. Now, again, today we say, well, that doesn't seem right. We're talking, you've got to be in their culture. You got to understand that this is what they would have thought back then. And so that becomes an important piece of the puzzle as well. The fact that they put women to testify first begs the question, why? And I think the best answer is the simplest, because they're just telling us what happened. And with the tomb itself, the scriptures tell us it was a new tomb, a rich man's tomb. Nobody had ever been in it before. It was an observed tomb. They knew exactly where it was. It had been secured and sealed with a Roman seal and guarded. And so when you have all these things where the tomb is basically set up with guards and seals and everybody's watching and looking, how then do you explain that the body is missing on the third day? And there have been a lot of attempted explanations over the years. Any attempt at an explanation admits that something happened. And the question is going to be what best explains this. The first explanation you might recall in Matthew 28 is the Jewish leaders there said the disciples stole the body, and they wanted to bribe the guards to say that. And that was the first explanation. Of course, some say the body was stolen. Some say the women went to the wrong tomb. Some say it really was just buried in a shallow grave. There's no evidence for that. Or that it was a hallucination. Everybody, you know, 500 at once saw the same hallucination. Or Jesus just swooned. He didn't really die. He just kind of fainted, and there's different theories about that. Some believe he was drugged, and it appeared that he was dead, but he really wasn't. But on the third day, he still woke up and was from the inside of the tomb, able to get out of the grave clothes and move the stone from the inside and scare the guard away and all of that. None of those make any sense. And the thing is, those are explanations that skeptics today have typically abandoned. They know it does. They know these explanations don't work. So the most common view today is that it's all just a legend. Didn't really happen. It's just like a fish story that grows over time. And, you know, after a while, they begin to say that Jesus rose from the dead. Maybe at first they meant that, you know, he was alive in their hearts, and so they just kind of ran with that. I want to show you in just a moment that that just doesn't work. And so none of these attempted explanations account for all of the facts. And so there has to be something else going on. But who would have invented this? We're going to talk in another lesson about the story no one would have invented, and we'll go into more detail about that. But this idea that, you know, somebody just made this up in a world where they didn't really believe in personal resurrections and things of that nature, there has to be more going on here than just that. So I'm come back to the Apostle Paul here for a few moments and think about the nature of this. Because I believe we can argue that this is not a legendary story that would have been invented either by Jewish or Gentile culture. And again, though belief in afterlife was common, belief in the bodily resurrection of a man was not a common thing. And, you know, you've got several sources, first century sources, that give the same basic facts. He died, he was buried, he was seen alive again. And you know, if there were no supernatural elements involved in this, very few would ever question it. So the question now is, what did Paul know? Why is Paul important to all of this? I think we have to bear in mind here that, again, the importance of Paul is that, first of all, he was initially opposed to Christ and the church. And this is something that skeptics admit, by the way. What I'm going to say right here up front about Paul is something that even the skeptics will admit to. And they understand he opposed Christ and the church. They also understand that he was converted and became a primary proponent of Christ and the church in the first century. In fact, many will even say that they think Paul is the one who invented Christianity. But here's what we have to see about this. Paul wrote epistles that even predated the gospel accounts. And that includes 1 Corinthians. And when I say this, again, skeptics will admit this. One of the most outspoken skeptics today, Bart Ehrman, will admit this. Paul wrote 1 Corinthians, and he wrote it sometime between 50 and 54 AD. And what that means is, you're talking about a document written right around 20 years after the events in question. If Jesus died on the cross sometime roughly between 30 and 33, and Paul writes 1 Corinthians between 50 and 54, we're within a 20 to 25 year period here of time. And historically speaking, that's not very long at all. My wife and I are going to be celebrating our 35th wedding anniversary 35 years ago. I remember that day pretty well. I have children who are coming into their 30s here. I remember their births very well. And the point is that when something big happens, 20 years ago isn't that long. 25 years isn't that long. And so historically speaking, when you have witnesses and documents that are written down within 20 years of the events that we're talking about in ancient history here, ancient times, that's amazing. And we have nothing else in ancient history that really even comes close to that. So we have to take into account, you know, and we're not saying here that we accept this just because it's part of what we call the Bible, but this is a document in the first century written within 20 years if you are just going to examine it historically, you have to take that into account. Now, we do believe it's inspired. We do believe it comes from God. But the point is, for its historical witness, we just recognize when it was written and by whom it was written and how close to the time frame it was written. And skeptics admit, again, that Paul has what Ehrman calls undisputed epistles. In other words, these are the epistles that all the skeptics will admit to. 1 Thessalonians, Romans, 1 and 2 Corinthians, Galatians, Philippians, and Philemon. And even if we just took those seven epistles, if we just took those for the sake of argument, what did Paul know about Jesus? Well, he knew Jesus was an Israelite of the tribe of David, Romans 1, Galatians 3. Paul knew that Jesus was born under the law, Galatians 4 and verse 4. Paul knew that Jesus had a brother named James, Galatians 1. Paul knew that he was poor, 2 Corinthians 8. He knew that he ministered among the Jews in Romans 15. He knew that he had 12 chosen disciples, 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 5. He also knew that Jesus instituted what we call the Lord's Supper, and he knew the very words that Jesus used. Remember in 1 Corinthians 11, again, this document written some 20 years after the events in question, Paul talks about the institution of the Lord's Supper and says it's on the same night that Jesus was betrayed that he took bread and he said this, "Do this in remembrance of me." So he knew what happened and he knew what Jesus said about that. That has to be explained. If you're going to be a skeptic about these things, you've got to be able to explain where that comes from. Because Paul wasn't sitting down with Matthew, Mark, and Luke in front of him. It's not like he had these a Bible in front of him with the gospel accounts and say, let me copy that down. This is an independent source from the gospel accounts. And so that's an important feature of this. Paul knew that he was crucified, buried, and then again argues he was raised from the dead with witnesses available even at the time he was writing. He knew that he was killed by his own countrymen in 1 Thessalonians 2. But he also knew that Jesus had the character, the kind of character that we have come to know in Jesus. He was meek and gentle, 2 Corinthians 10. He was humble and obedient to God in Philippians 2 and Romans 5. He was filled with grace and love, 2 Corinthians 8 and Romans 8. He was righteous and sinless. Paul even knew of the teachings of Jesus, aside from the Lord's Supper that we've mentioned. Paul knew something about his teachings about marriage and divorce, for example, in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. Here are some things he said, here are some things he didn't say. So he was aware of that. He knew that. He talks about the right of preachers to meet material needs in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, which was something that Jesus even taught, being worthy of wages and so forth. And in all of these things, we're still just confining ourselves to these seven epistles for just a moment. How does Paul describe Jesus? Well, he describes him as Christ, who is God over all. Romans chapter 9 and verse 5. He describes him as one who shared the very nature of God, Philippians 2, 6 through 11. He called him the Son of God, Romans 1, 3 and 4. And when you survey these epistles, you'll find multiplied times that he calls Jesus the Christ, the King, the Anointed One. And you'll also find multiple times that he refers to Jesus as the Lord. And so just in those seven epistles, Paul demonstrates a deep knowledge of Jesus, a deep knowledge of the character of Jesus and the identity of Jesus. He knew who Jesus was. He knew what Jesus did. He knew the kind of person Jesus was. He knew what happened, and he pointed to eyewitnesses and he says, "They're still with us." As if to say, you can check with them about these things. So in that very brief survey of this, we have to kind of take the various aspects of the evidences that are out there and ask, what is it that best explains all of this together? What would keep me from believing this? And I believe that basically what would keep me from believing is the problem of presuppositions. Now, what I mean by that is that we often have presuppositions. We presuppose things about reality even before we have our discussions. The evidence here historically is good for Scripture. That's not the problem. The problem is that it contains supernatural elements. And there's a lot of people who are going to approach this with an attitude that says, first of all, I don't believe anything supernatural could happen because I don't believe in God, for example. And since the Bible talks about supernatural elements, that tells me it must be wrong from the beginning. So before they even examine the actual evidence, they've already decided that because the Bible has miracles, it can't be true. And if that's the kind of approach that we're taking here, then it's not evidence that dismisses the Bible. It's presuppositions about truth that dismiss the Bible. And often it's the presuppositions that deny it rather than the actual evidence. So I have to ask people, would presuppositions keep a person from believing? Well, the answer is they often do. But if we can kind of back up sometimes and identify those presuppositions, if the presupposition is reality is confined to nature alone and there can be no God, if that's the presupposition, and by the way, that's not provable by science. You can't prove scientifically that nature alone is all there is. But if that's the presupposition, then coming into the text of Scripture, someone has already decided before they've even looked at it that it can't be true. So sometimes we have to back up and kind of identify those presuppositions and then move forward from there. And what would resurrection mean here? How will a resurrection affect my life? And I think when we recognize that what the resurrection of Christ has done, there are three places real briefly I would just mention here. 1 Peter chapter 1 tells us in verse 3 that we've been born again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, to an inheritance that is incorruptible, undefiled, does not fade away, reserved in heaven for you who are kept by the power of God through faith. So what the resurrection means is I've been born again to a living hope. And that changes my perspective on everything. Secondly, Romans chapter 6, 3 through 5, talking there about baptism. And what baptism really is there is a burial. It's a death. You're dead in sin. You're buried with Christ in baptism, into his death, and raised up to walk in newness of life. So in that sense, then baptism becomes a mirror of the death and resurrection of Jesus. And so I just like to ask people at that point, have you been raised with Christ? And Romans 10, 9 and 10 tells us that we must believe in the heart that God has raised him from the dead. We must confess with the mouth, Jesus is Lord. And that's not just a one-time confession, by the way. That's not just a confession you make right before you're baptized. That is a lifetime confession that is based upon the life you live. Remember, we tie this back to the lesson on faith. Faith is the demonstration of the conviction that we believe that there's something there that is not something we see. But we believe in God, and we believe that he raised Jesus from the dead, and we believe that Jesus is Lord. His identity is set and settled in the resurrection, and we understand then that changes and affects everything about our lives. And so as we think about the importance of the resurrection, think about how significant our lives are based upon the resurrection and what that means for the way we live our lives. And I thank you for your attention.